Are you feeling burnt out, overwhelmed, like you're just an Uber driver to your kids' endless appointments? Do you wonder, is this all there is? Stop driving around and try something different. Book in with Body and Mind Online for expert speech therapy, occupational therapy, psychologist and counsellors via telehealth. I founded Body and Mind Online 5 years ago, and it has since been one of the most inclusive therapy centres in the country. This podcast is my passion project. But I've realized that by not openly recommending Body and Mind Online, I'm leaving many of you to navigate the daunting task of finding the right providers on your own. Stop the struggle and get the support that you and your family deserve. Visit adhdmums.com.au and visit the therapy page to take the first step forward towards a balanced life with Body and Mind Online. Welcome to the ADHD Mums Podcast, a safe place for everyday Australian mums to discuss their struggles with ADHD, motherhood and life. Hello and welcome to the next episode of ADHD Mums. Today we have someone that I've been circling for a long time. Not that he knows that, but I have been circling his team for a long time. We have Justin Coulson. How are you, Justin?
So nice to be with you, Jane. I feel a little bit stalked.
Oh, you should.
I just feel like I should check my shoulder more often.
You should, because when I stalk people, I'm really relentless.
Well, you got me. Here I am.
If you don't know who Justin Coulson is, he is the co-host and parenting expert on Channel 9's Parental Guidance and the founder of happyfamilies.com.au. He has a PhD in psychology and is one of Australia's most trusted parenting experts. Over the past decade, he has helped innumerable families with his 9 books about raising children, his hundreds of media appearances, and his 2 viral videos, which have been viewed a combined of 80 million times. Justin earned his PhD in psychology from the University of Wollongong, and him and his wife have been married since the late 90s, and they are the parents of 6 daughters and the grandparents of 1 granddaughter. Welcome to you, Justin.
Hey, thanks so much, Jane.
One of the reasons that I brought Justin on was because I'm obviously a fan, but secondly, because he has lived experience with neurodivergence, which I know everyone loves on this podcast. Can you explain a little bit more about that, Justin?
Yeah, we have one of our daughters, scores off the charts. Do you know what? I'm pretty glib about this. I know some people are very, very sensitive. So if you are a sensitive person, you might not like the way that I talk about it. I'm okay with that. You don't have to like it. But I just kind of say how it is. And she's nuts. She's nuts. In fact, we've got another one, an older one, where it's so funny. Jane, I know that your psychological background should have set you up perfectly to know that you had it and that your kids had it and you missed it all. I've got a PhD in psychology. I'm supposed to know this stuff. And yet my daughter was just my daughter and she was normal in her normal way, which was not really normal. So she's in her 20s. She's overseas at the moment. Almost no doubt at all that she should have and could have received a diagnosis. Got another one who absolutely is scoring off the charts. And I feel a bit uncomfortable saying this because I don't have a diagnosis. But again, with the psychology background that I've got, and as I've looked at it a lot more, I've realized that I'm pretty good at ticking all those boxes personally as well. And what I've done is over the last, I mean, I'm nearly 50. I've just figured out how to structure my life in such a way that any dysfunction or challenge that might come from the characteristics and traits that ADHD presents, I've just figured out ways around them. Either I've hired people in my team to look after stuff, or I just don't do some things. Like delegation or ignoring tend to work pretty well for me. And I've created a business and a life where I get to harness the strengths that come with these characteristics and attributes and really magnify and amplify them for my benefit rather than to my detriment. And so I guess those characteristics have become features, not bugs.
How do you go with burnout then? Because that's a really big factor for people with ADHD. Like you're doing it all and you've got your scaffolding, you've all got it set up, but do you not have burnout constantly?
And anxiety. So my wife will tell you that she lives with the constant seesaw of my, I'd almost call it a bipolar nature. Again, I don't want to overdiagnose myself or be too glib about it, but I'm really, really high and everything's going great. And then everything's crashing down and everything's ending and I might as well quit. And I don't know why I'm doing this. I've overcome the whole imposter syndrome thing. Like I know what I know and I know that I do it well. Again, I've figured out where my features are and where my bugs are. But the up and down is really, really hard for my wife and family. And over time, I've learned to harness it better and I've learned who to say certain things to. And there are just some things that I try not to talk to my wife about finances more than once every 3 months. Maybe even once every 6 months. Why? Because if I told her how I was feeling today versus tomorrow, we'd be on this up and down all the time. See, this is the thing. I've forgotten what you were saying. This is what happens. I get carried away. I get on my tangent.
Burnout.
Oh, yeah. a couple of times a year, I probably think to myself, I just can't do this anymore. I don't know why I'm doing this. It's too hard. I need to quit. And then I look at the reality of the life that I've built. And I'm like, no, I really like what I'm doing and I need to stick with it. Or we'll go away on a holiday. A couple of months ago, we had a family trip for a couple of weeks away. And I was literally at the point where I was thinking, I don't know if I can do this for much longer. Came back from the holiday and it was an intense adventure holiday. I don't do lay on the beach holidays, not in my nature, not interested in slowing down. My life philosophy, somebody asked me this and I said it just joking. Maybe 15, 20 years ago, I said, bite off more than you can chew and make it up as you go along. And
wow, you and I are similar. Yes.
And I don't know if that sort of ticks some ADHD boxes for you or not, but that's how I've always just attack life. Just go at it. Go really, really hard at it. Have no idea what I'm doing and just figure it out. Like you said, burnout, that's exhausting. It's unhealthy. It's far too much. And yet we just kind of, I don't know. Well, we work it out.
Yeah. You know, one thing that's really interesting to me is the gender differences. So for example, my husband, I have diagnosed him with ADHD and he hasn't received a formal diagnosis. He doesn't take medication and that's not a problem. Self-diagnosis is just as good as a proper one. And the proper ones are very expensive and long waits, et cetera, et cetera. The way we've set our life up though, is that a lot of that executive function tasks are with me. And I spoke to a pediatrician recently and she's, and this again could be inflammatory and it's the worst, and I'm air quoting worst, the worst affected families are the families where the mum has ADHD. Because I think that that's like what kid has what library bag, what kid has what lunchbox, they've all got sensory issues with the food. You got to remember who's got what. And I think that's something that has been a real struggle for me because it's like you can't avoid it unless you hire a nanny. And I'm like, I can't give it to my husband. So it's like, if you're 5 for 5, it's like someone has to do the things.
Yeah. Something that we've done, Jane, because I know what I'm like, I actually double down on the structure. I double down on the routine. So for example, a few months ago, Kylie went away for nearly 2 weeks. She wanted a break. She was given an opportunity to go away with a friend, discount holiday, didn't have to pay for accommodation. It was an opportunity that was too good to say no to. So she went. And for the time that she was away and I was at home, well, actually, I wasn't at home. I was traveling and I was giving talks and I took one of the kids with me and then I was home for a few days. And it was essentially, I sit down with the kids and because I know what I'm like and because I know that if I don't get on top of it, it's going to be chaos. We create the structure, we create the routine, we create the format. And then I get really serious about, we've got to follow this. We've got to stay on task because if we don't, it's going to turn into chaos. And I don't deal very well with that. And so for me, pushing really hard into structure works extremely well because the alternative is that I start to lose it. I don't deal with the chaotic, messy, what's happening next and why didn't that happen and all that sort of thing. So that's kind of there's a little bit of rigidity in there that works really nicely for me. If I go back to your burnout question again, though, something else that I've figured that really, really works extremely well, and it requires a little bit of selfishness, which never goes down well, especially with mums. I get up early and I exercise every day. I've got a far too expensive bike and I get on the bike and I ride it every single day or as many days as I possibly can. If I'm not on the bike, I'm in the surf. If I'm not in the surf, I'm swimming laps in the pool. I do a couple of Ks, maybe 2 or 3 Ks every time I go for a swim. There seems to be something that helps me in that physical activity, specifically physical activity outside in nature and often where possible with friends, the social side, the physical activity, the nature all combining. It gets rid of the negativity for me. It's not that it necessarily pumps me up and boosts me, but if there's any negativity, anything that I'm holding onto in a residual form or any stress, it helps to calm that and keep it at low level so I can focus on the stuff that I need to focus on. I turn into a version of me that's not my best if I fail to do that consistently.
Yeah, okay, that makes sense. A question that I know is going to come up if I don't ask it is when you were talking about doubling down on structure, do you mean like visual aids, visual charts, like this is what's happening next? Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, lists. I don't like having stuff on the fridge because it's messy and it doesn't work for me. And we also have a fridge that doesn't take magnets. It means blue tack and I just drives me crazy. And one of my kids loves to get the blue tack and take it off the back of everything. She adds some moisturizer to it and it turns it into a sort of a goopy, blue tacky, just gross thing that she plays with for hours, and it makes mess everywhere and leaves smudges on the tables and the benches. So no blue tack. Sorry, I'm tangent there. Just lists, lots and lots of lists. Who's doing what? Where are we doing it? How are we doing it? What's for dinner? Who's cooking it? Just the more we get clear on the structure, the more I can relax. Because if we get on the structure, my brain doesn't stop worrying about the next thing that we have to do and how we're going to get that done. And I'm sounding a little bit dysfunctional the more I say it. I always thought that I was kind of normal, but pulling this apart and being a bit psychoanalytical about myself is making me feel a bit uncomfortable. Jane, what are you doing to me?
I'm actually listening to this going, oh, I'm loving it, because it's like it all resonates with me. And I think everyone listening to this will be like, oh, yeah, no, we totally get that. I feel I often...
Yeah, but I look like I've got it together, Jane. I look like, when you look at my social media account, I look like I've got it together. I look like I know exactly what I'm doing, and you found me out.
I know. I think we've found a bit of masking here, ladies, with Justin Coulton. I think he has got the face out there, but I think there's a little bit of chaos going on underneath, which we love. Here's a question that everyone wants to know, because I know that you run both neurodiverse and also neurotypical programs for parenting.
Right.
Do you think it is harder to parent a neurodiverse child? And if so, why?
Oh, it's undeniable. I don't even have to think about it. The simple answer is yes. What will often happen, I'll give a talk at a conference, for example. So I'm standing up in front of 500, 600, 700 people. I try to remember to always acknowledge when I'm giving the talk that if you are raising an ADHD or an autistic child, the same principles that I'm sharing apply. I don't change the framework, the system that I teach. The evidence underpinning it is simply far too strong, and there is nothing better that's out there. In fact, I'm just reaching across now. I have a paper on my desk right now that was published in Psychological Review in 2022. It's called Seeking Connection, Autonomy, and Emotional Feedback, a Self-Determination Theory of Self-Regulation in Attention Deficit Hyperactivity Disorder. It's by this great researcher called Rebecca Champ at the University of Huddersfield. I'm sort of making my way through that one at the moment. And the reason that I share that is because the framework that I use is known from a psychological perspective as self-determination theory. It argues that there are three basic psychological needs. And when we support those needs, our children thrive, they're motivated, their well-being increases. When we thwart or frustrate those needs, their well-being drops and their motivation drops, and we have all sorts of struggles. And whether you have a neurodivergent child or you have a neurotypical child is irrelevant. The needs remain. It's just that it can be harder to create a need supportive environment when you've got a kid who is living in an environment that doesn't in any way support them. We've got to just go the extra mile. We've got to do the extra work. And of course, there's the genetic component of neurodiversity as well, which adds that level of complexity, because quite often as parents, if we have a diagnosis or if we tick the boxes and we've just self-diagnosed, we know that the world, the environment, the home, the work, the whatever, that is often not ticking the boxes for us in terms of supporting our basic psychological needs. And so we're going downhill there as well. All that is to say, it's much more complex. It's much harder for families with neurodiversity to do the stuff that I'm talking about, but there's simply nothing better than it. I mean, you can pull out all the rewards and punishments, all the carrots and sticks that you want. That's not the way forward with neurodiversity. It simply dehumanizes your child and makes you feel like a crappy parent. When you follow the model that I am really explicit about and teach as clearly as I can, that's the model that moves you in the right direction. It's just harder. Full stop, end of story.
Thank you for the validation. We all love that, don't we? That makes total sense to me because, as I said, I've been a longtime fan well before you even bought out your membership is how long I've been following you. By the time we actually got diagnosed, I was still following the program, but it was interesting because I reflected that the things that I had been doing were the things that had worked anyway. So there was actually no real change, but I think the level of understanding and the more time, like we started to allow 30 minutes to get in the car, for example, because we were like, let's just no longer expect that we can just get in the car quickly. Let's just not even expect that. But the actual strategies remain the same. So I think that's a great point, actually.
I love that example of getting in the car as well, because there are two things that I want to say about this. First is, if you want to get into the car faster, it's on you as the parent, especially when your children are really young, it's on you as the parent to set up a system that supports your children's effectiveness. expecting your children when it's not developmentally appropriate, either through neurotypical or neurodivergent development, it's not fair to expect them to do things that are beyond their developmental capacity. So you don't expect your three-year-old to tie up their shoelaces or even put their shoes on, for example. And if you're expecting them to do that, you're going to have a really frustrating morning. But you can set your morning up in such a way that obstacles are smoothed over a little bit, or at least appropriate support is available when the kids need it, such as, hey, kiddo, what did I just ask you to do? I noticed that you're still playing with the dog, but I asked you to do something a minute ago. And when your child looks at you and says, well, I don't know, you say, well, here's what it was that I asked you to do. And then you wait and say, would you like my help with that? Or have you got this? And so what you're doing is, instead of telling them what to do constantly, you're offering them support and you're guiding them through the morning. So those kinds of tweaks to the structure will make a huge difference. Another one of my favorites is your morning begins the night before. So if you want to have a really effective morning, before everyone goes to bed, get the school uniforms out, find the school shoes, find the library bag, find the library book, because you know you're not going to be able to find it. You just won't find it tomorrow morning when chaos is happening. And the more you can prep the night before, the smoother your morning is the next day. The second thing that I want to emphasize here as well is that when you do just recognize that your child is going to take 30 minutes to get in the car, on those days where they get in 15 minutes or 12 minutes, you're pleasantly surprised and you have a really relaxed drive to school. Everyone's in a great mood. You've got the headspace to put some music on and have a sing along or talk to them about their day. And when they get out of the car, you're feeling good and they're feeling good. And it's really reinforcing. It helps you to know, we can do this. It feels like there's great value in just that one example.
You know, I have a burning question for you that I think we actually talk about this a lot in the Facebook group. Obviously, all children love iPads, right? And neurodiverse children love iPads even more. And so initially, like, I just have so much trouble getting my three kids ready in the morning. You know, most people do, but I think that I do have some serious stuff going on here. Someone suggested to me, why don't you give them their iPad if they're ready? So if you're leaving at 7:45 and they're ready at 7:30, whoever's ready gets an iPad for the 15 minutes. So we started doing that, and my two boys, who are iPad mad, and we don't hand them out that often, so it's very high value, I put it on with a timer for 15 minutes, right? And my daughter takes forever. That's a whole nother thing, right? She's never got an iPad once. Basically, these iPads have become problematic because getting them off the iPad is a whole nother thing. And then often one of them runs off to go do something else. I said to my husband last night, should we just turf these iPads? Because it gets them moving, but then we can't get them off it. And then it's a crisis at the end. And I'm not talking roadblocks. I'm just talking like a bit of Minecraft education.
But I love burning questions. They're the ones that excite me the most. And this is one of the trickiest ones. I don't know what it is about neurodiversity. I think that if we go back to, I mentioned three basic psychological needs before, the self-determination theory framework. I didn't talk about what they were. Let me describe them briefly because it'll help to answer the question. So we have three basic psychological needs. When they're supported, we feel great. When they're not supported, we feel terrible. The quality of our motivation improves and becomes more internalized when basic psychological needs are supported, and it becomes more externalized and lower quality motivation, external motivation, when they're not. The three needs are, number one, a sense of relationship, belonging, mattering. Number two, a sense of competence and capability, mastery or progress. And number three, a sense of autonomy, behaving the way that I feel that I should based on what I know to be good, right, and helpful. This, and to be clear, autonomy doesn't mean independence. It's a slightly different thing. It's very much about volition and a sense of control, but not necessarily total freedom and independence. So from a screen perspective, when I get on the screen, I feel like everything is right with my relationships because I have my friends who are online. So there's the social aspect, but also I'm shutting out all of the relationships that are around me that can sometimes stress me out, especially if I'm a neurodivergent kid who finds family life to be a lot and there's too much input, there's too much noise, there's too much everything. From a competence point of view and a capability point of view, you find that all of the games, all of the systems that are set up, I mean, the technology and the way that these devices and platforms have been designed is nothing short of frightening in terms of the way it taps into our psychology and helps us to feel like we're doing everything just right. Or if we're not doing everything right, we're making progress and we're nearly there. You look at the way games keep you hooked, even as an adult, they really feed that competence need, that mastery need supremely well. And autonomy, I mean, I'm doing what I want. It feels really good. It's a great place to be. So kids want to be on screens, especially neurodivergent kids, but even neurotypical kids love screens because of the profoundly effective way, the frighteningly, scarily effective way that the people who have designed these platforms tap into their basic psychological needs. I frankly don't think that we can compete with it in the real world. I don't think that we can support basic psychological needs. Well, actually, let me rephrase. We can, because the screens are fundamentally a hollow, shallow imitation of the real thing. But they're just so compelling. And there's always the promise that next time it is going to be better. Next time I can get there. It just feels so close. And our brain struggles to know the difference until you have the richness of a real experience off the screen. That's why the kids want to be on the screens. I just wanted to get that clear. That's why they want to be there. Our job is to help them to have really good relationships off the screen, feel like they're competent progressing off the screen, and feel like they've got a say in what's happening in their world off the screen. But have a think about your typical morning. How much do your children feel like they're in a mutually connected and warm, nurturing relationship every morning? Because what's our morning look like? Where are your shoes? Where's your bag? Get ready. Why is this taking so long? No, not like that, like this. Like relationship needs are not being supported offline. And then when they are online, because you've given them the iPad, then you start saying, you've got 2 minutes to go. 1 minute. All right, it's time to go. Give me the screen out. So again, the screen is so comfortable and safe. And offline, it's like, oh, I'm always getting in trouble. Relationships aren't good offline, but they're very good online. From a competence point of view, the kids don't feel competent when they're not on the screen. Why? Because we have to keep on telling them what to do and how to do it and why they're not doing it right and how they're supposed to change things. And from an autonomy point of view, we're constantly controlling them. Okay, so that's why the screen's so attractive. Now, to answer your question specifically about should you use the screen as a reward, I want to share three ideas here that really unpack why I would say no, clearly and firmly, unquestionably no. The first is this: offering the screen as a reward has a hidden punishment inside it. And you described how your two sons get access to the screens, but your daughter doesn't. And so what happens for her is she feels like she's not good enough. She feels like she can't do it. She feels like she's being punished. She feels like she's deficient, dysfunctional, can't get it right. And it also affects her relationship with her brothers because they always get to have the fun and she never gets to have the fun. So it ruptures your relationship with her. It ruptures her feelings of competence and it ruptures her relationship with her brothers. In all three of those areas, we're making things worse, not better. The second concern that I have is that when we're doing it, we're actually ignoring the fundamental reasons for the challenges in the first place. So when we're offering rewards, we're basically saying, I know you're struggling with this, but we're going to pretend you're not struggling and I'm going to dangle this carrot here. And if you can just figure things out, I can't figure it out, but if you can figure it out, you get the goodie.
That's basically it, yeah.
And so we're ignoring the underlying reasons for the incompetence, for the dysfunction, for the challenges that we're having. Now, obviously, we know, okay, it's ADHD or it's autism or whatever. Nevertheless, if we don't get to the root of it, the key word that psychologists use in this research area is if you want somebody to be competent, you have to develop a structure or a system or rules and boundaries and guidelines, I don't care what you want to call it, so that they can play the game competently, get through mornings competently and capably, or at least make progress in that direction. A simple example is if you're on the soccer field and you're playing a game of soccer and then someone picks up the ball and runs with it in their hands, they're no longer playing by the rules. They're no longer playing soccer competently and the game changes. It's no longer fun. Now you have to put your shoulder into them and knock them to the ground and say, that's not how we play soccer. This is a really big challenge. You want to work out, well, why did this kid feel like they needed to pick up the ball and run with it? Oh, they thought it was boring. They wanted to play footy. They wanted to. And as you get to the reasons, then you can work out, well, what should we do now? Do we exclude this kid from the game? Do we send them over there to where rugby training is? Or do we start playing some touch footy or some contact football ourselves because we're all feeling a bit bored? Rewards ignore the reason for the challenging behavior. The third thing that I would say is unfortunately, there's an unwillingness to get off the device at the end, and that causes more strain and more trouble and more contention and more hassle in our family. And it makes the kids feel like they're always in trouble, and it hurts our relationships. And so it's easier, I think, to just not give it to them. You wouldn't say to an alcoholic, you know what, you've been really good today. Or if you get this done, I'll give you a drink. Because the ramifications of that, the long-term ramifications, are just devastating. While I'm not comparing ADHD to alcoholism, what I am comparing is the difficulty in stopping the problematic behavior once it starts. And we know that once those kids are on screens, it can be really, really tough. Now, as they get older, more mature, and as they learn, ADHD is fundamentally a regulation issue, right? It's an inhibition and regulation issue. So as they get older and mature, they will naturally become better at self-regulation. And that's when you can start to work on things and say, here's what we're thinking about doing. And if this happens, here's how we're going to work through it. And you can make plans and structures to help them to be competent, so you don't have to have big blow-ups. But it's tricky and it takes time.
I appreciate that, because my husband and I were actually talking and we were saying last night, that's not working. We need to make a change. But I was also, I suppose, looking for confirmation, because I was like, that's going to make life a little difficult initially, probably long-term easier. But yeah. You know, you kind of like want to be sure before you go and make your own life any harder than it is.
So Jane, with our ADHD daughter, we've discovered that it's just not feasible for her to have access to the iPad. She was actually okay at school, but unfortunately, some educators in her sphere were not particularly effective at responding to neurodivergent behavior. And school became very, very hard for her. So we brought her home and we just found that the iPad was a disaster. It was just too hard for all the reasons that I've explained. And so we just sat down with her and said, kiddo, you're going to be really upset about this, but here's what we're seeing. And she argued with us the whole time. And here's what we're going to do. We're going to take the iPad away. It's only coming out when we go on long trips and when we're on holidays, and it suits our family to use it. I mean, there was a blow up. It was monumental. It was huge. And for a couple of days, there were sads and she wouldn't do any homeschool work until she got the iPad back. And we said, sorry, no iPad. And we just held that boundary and sat with the reality that she was going to be uncomfortable and miserable about it. And after two or three days, she bounced back and we got on with it. And not having the iPad in our sphere has been, I was going to say game changer, but I'd go further. I'd say it's been life changing. Like, it's been so dramatically helpful. But if you decide to go to that path, you need to know, number one, explanations and rationales matter. Number two, the kids will argue like their life depends on it. And number three, there will be a couple of days, at least a couple of days, of significant discomfort where you're just going to have to compassionately and kindly hold your ground. You don't have to keep on explaining it. You've already done that, but just hold your ground and say, I know it's hard. I get it. Give them lots of hugs. And in a couple of days, they will work through it and they will be okay. No child that I'm aware of has ever gone into such a depression that they can't come out of it after being taken away from screens. Pretty much the opposite. Everyone I talk to who's done it has said, oh my goodness, I got my child back again after about 4 or 5 days.
Yeah, we've taken them away before and had the same experience. My hubby started working at night and on the weekends. And so I think they crept back in, and because it was so difficult on me, right?
Yeah, they're so convenient. They just make life easier.
It just felt like I could just do something for an hour. And it started off quite innocent, but I think the balance and the moderation has always been an issue in my home. I think we might do a tech ban, Justin. I will blame you to my children. I'll go, oh, Dr. Justin, right. He said it.
Happy families. This business is called Happy Families. Look how miserable our family is now. Oh,
I know. My six-year-old's really mouthy, so he would probably be like, oh, the happy family man. I bet you he's got an angry family at him.
Yes. Yeah, sometimes I do.
Anyway, we are going to finish it up there. Thank you so much for your time, Justin. Do you have anything else to add before we finish up?
Well, first of all, thanks for having me. I've really enjoyed the conversation. It's been a lot of fun. Secondly, I know that we've said this, but it's worth underscoring it. Parenting is hard. Research tells us that more parents are struggling with parental burnout than at any time in the history of the world. It's a really tough gig. We put a lot of pressure on ourselves. Our children often have challenges that they bring to parenting. But what I guess would like to wrap up with, third and finally, is that we don't need to make it harder than it already is. And there are things that we can do to make it easier. If we want to make our parenting easier, especially when we have neurodivergent children, my encouragement would be to help your kids to have more unstructured time That is time where you're not telling them what to do and they're not engaged in activities that you've paid for them to be in where there's an adult supervising them. Unstructured times mean you take them down to the beach or down to the park, or you take them on a bike ride and you just let them do that. Now, of course, the thing that you need more than anything here is time. And I know that what I'm saying therefore feels really unfair, but the more your kids can be one, outdoors, two, with friends, peers, kids their own age, and three, playing in unstructured ways with minimal to no parental engagement, the better they'll be. We've got to give them the space, obviously developmentally appropriately. You're not going to let your five-year-old go and play in the park on their own. But if you've got a couple of 11-year-olds, I think that's okay. Let them get down to the park and have a play, or let them go to the beach and have a play. Obviously, they need to be mindful with water and that kind of stuff. We've got to have common sense around this. The more they can be one, outside, two, with friends, and three, having unstructured and even risky play, the more resilient they'll be, the more they'll learn how to regulate. And this is the critical thing. They'll learn how to regulate because they're the ones that have to do the regulating. You're not there to do it. This is how we help our kids to learn how to inhibit, how to regulate, how to take appropriate risks, how to manage their anxiety, and how to live. I mean, they live a full and rich life. That to me is I guess, the hope that I would like to leave you with. And the goal, the thing to work towards as the kids get older, giving them those experiences and helping them to do that will help them to navigate life with neurodiversity in really healthy ways.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much for your time, Justin. I really appreciate it.
Great. Thanks, Jane.
The key message here is you are not alone. Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, follow us on Instagram or head over and join our amazing ADHD Mums podcast Facebook community. Everything you do matters and helps to spread the word about what neurodiversity in females looks like.